From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Working As Intended Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor,
and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are debugging and silent protagonists. So, everyone is ready. Let's start.
Okay, before we get into anything, we have to do the thing we promised to do for the next couple episodes.
That's right.
Which is to hype the Wordplay Conference.
Wordplay yes. Conference! Hype, hype, hype!
So if you didn't hear us in the last couple weeks, Wordplay Conference is a yearly event put on by Hand Eye Society in Toronto.
Yes.
It's online this year as it was last. And our game Glom is part of it. Mm-hmm. It's a conference that celebrates the use of words and language in games. And Glom does exactly that. And they agreed. And so we're going to have a showcase as part of that stream, which is going to be on Twitch. We'll have the link in the show notes. And I'm just kind of going through all of the same details that we talked about last episode.
Yeah. I'll add one.
Yes, please.
There's a lot of cool stuff linked on their site. So like they, you know, they have links to games that were featured from past conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some really cool stuff on there.
Yeah. Innovative.
Really innovative, really interesting themes. And I don't have the page open right now for two reasons. Well, no, just one reason. And that's if it were open right now, it'd be really distracting for the rest of the episode.
There's a lot of stuff on
there.
Yeah,
there's a lot of really cool stuff. But like Mark just said, we'll link the conference website in the show notes. Mm-hmm. And we'll probably, you know, be tweeting it out, you know, coming up to the show and stuff like that. Or coming up to the conference, the date of the conference. And you can just Google it.
Yep. It is November 13th and 14th on Twitch. And you can see Glom and a bunch of other cool stuff. And you can check out the website for past stuff like Ellen was just mentioning. So please do.
Yeah.
Do we have any other topics at the top of the show, or do we want to get into it? So my topic... It's just all plugs at the top of the show now.
Yep.
No banter.
Yep.
Straight to it now.
Yep.
I'm going to talk about debugging. So we were looking at, this is something I've been dealing with a lot for the game I'm working on.
Yeah.
We have a publisher deadline, which from where I'm sitting is in a couple of days.
Oh boy.
And I've been working on a refactor of a system that we figured out it was just fine. Mm-hmm. But then it resulted in like a whole wake of bugs, just tons of them in its path.
Oh gosh.
And so and I created all of these, so like I am just like nose down fixing them before I can merge all my changes back into the main branch of the repo. And it is slowing me down, and it's like I'm still dealing with it, and I only have a couple of days left. Now our publisher has been super great, but like I can't account on their generosity. I can't abuse their generosity.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about this a lot, because one of the approaches that I take to debugging, and we've talked about this on the show before, is this idea that like once you face a problem, you just don't leave it sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
Because Steven, I know you've talked about how you and the Fingens team did that for a long time.
Yeah.
And then it took a long time to clean that stuff up later.
Yes.
And that's the general reason why you don't want to do that. But there are pluses and minuses too, we'll get into.
Yep.
But I'm very aggressive about that. I will stop what I'm doing, and because I'm kind of I'm a little bit, I have a bit of an addictive personality. So the thing I'm working on now will never bore me. I will just keep going forever. So I'm really suited to this kind of workflow.
Yeah.
What that means is it's going to be a long time before I can get to the next thing.
Yeah.
And if the thing takes longer than it's supposed to, what a good idea would be to patch it up so it's kind of okay, put a note down, track it, and move the hell on.
Yeah.
And I have a difficult time doing that. And so that's coming to bite me right now.
If it helps at all, Mark, it's not just you.
Yeah. But so that's the reason I want to talk about it. And I've sort of like, you know, spoiled a bit of the conversation for later. But we have talked about bugs on the show before. Yes. In our very first year. It was like the fifth episode, right?
Yeah.
And so this has been something that we kind of haven't officially gone back to since then, because it's like we've done it. But it's been quite a while since then, and so it's good to sort of revisit it in a way.
Yeah. I mean, you guys are more, we're all the more developed as developers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, well, and the tools have probably changed, and there's more thinking about best practices and processes and stuff. It's always good to revisit.
Yeah.
Revisit topics.
Yeah.
I know, certainly back then, I was not a Unity developer, principally. Right. So now, knowing the way that debugging, the state of debugging in Unity is a whole thing that I want to get into. But let's talk about the tools, right? The actual, you know, what it is that you do. So basically a debugging, if you, I mean, just as a general description, if you're not, you know, too embarrassed to ask. I mean, you know, a lot of us are self-taught, so sometimes you don't really know what these things are like formally, you know, as.
Absolutely.
But basically, it's a process by which you find the bug, right?
Yes.
And so the simplest way, and the way we've all done it, is you put print statements, or in Unity, it's debug.log.
Actually, people in Unity sometimes do print. My old job, like, people did print all the time, and it got on my nerves.
Yeah, print is an alias for debug.log, but it only works in mono behaviors.
Yes.
So if you're using other classes, you have to remember that it's debug.log.
That's exactly why I hate it when people do it. Just use debug.log.
Like, debug.log is accessible as part of the Unity API outside of a mono behavior.
Yes.
So why is print only an alias inside?
It's absolutely true. Yeah.
It's a piece of nonsense.
Didn't mean to distract us, though. Sorry.
I've gone in and have replaced a couple of those ones that I put in. Like, oh, this is convenient. It reminds me of the old, like, in Flash. That's what you'd say print.
Yeah.
Or trace. It was trace.
Actually, that's probably why people do it.
Yeah, it's just simpler. Like, why is it this dot that? Just give me something simpler than that.
Yeah.
But because it's not available across the whole API, debug.log is smarter. Or write your own alias, I guess.
Yeah, that worked.
Anyways.
Sorry.
I mean, just like debugging, you can get distracted.
Yes.
And this can definitely happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the basic process is to write one of these trace statements or print statements or debug.log statements.
Yeah.
And what it does is it just prints to the console where it reached that point in the code, usually you're able to put strings in there. I do 3 exclamation points is my default.
Which is very smart.
It's just like I just know that it reached that point, right? Mm-hmm. But you want to put you can put variables in there. You can have it display anything you want, whatever the current state of the game is, and that's very useful. But it's not really proper debugging. Like, what you really should be doing is a breakpoint.
Oh, yeah.
And now a breakpoint is basically exactly the same thing, but it's more formal. It's where you actually tell the program to stop at that spot as it's executing the code.
Yeah.
And then you enter a new environment where you're able to inspect all the pieces of memory in that moment. And then you can play again, right? Mm-hmm. It's much more useful. You don't have to decide what to put in that statement.
Yeah.
You just stop, and then you can then poke around.
Yes.
Now, people don't do this in Unity that much because for two reasons. One, Unity debugging, like getting it set up, is actually kind of difficult.
Yes.
Not that it's impossible. It's just like tedious, and like a lot of us don't bother.
Yeah.
The second thing is that when you're in Unity and you pause the editor, you can the inspector shows a lot of variables and values. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what a breakpoint is.
Yeah.
Is you can look into the current memory state of the application. And so I think that it's really easy to be very critical of people who just use debug.log statements.
Yeah.
But they actually have a lot more powerful tools within the Unity editor that aren't available to people who are just using code SDKs the way I used to.
Another reason why I do it is because it's very slow, it feels like to me, to do breakpoints and stuff. Mm-hmm. I find it much faster just real quick. And maybe it's because I'm used to it, but I find it faster to just do a debug.log thing to see where, if this code is executing the way I expect it to and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the reason I get frustrated when I do it is because I know I'm modifying the code to put those statements in and modifying again to clean it all up or comment them out. Just feels very messy.
That's fair.
But because the Unity editor gives you so much access to it's a reason why a lot of stuff, we make variables public when we don't have to, just so we can see what the value is.
Just use serialize fields.
Exactly right. Yeah, the way Unity does public and private variables is absolute nonsense.
Ellen, you keep giving us faces.
Well, I have no idea what you're talking about.
I know, sorry.
It is remarkably easy. You know, you want it, like a topic like this, you want to be kind of broad, but it's remarkably easy to start talking specifics.
Yeah. Well, it's a process, it's an action. I mean, I didn't mean to sound like I wasn't enjoying it. I don't know what you're talking about, but that's fine.
No, I can see the excitement in your face, but also the confusion. That's
yeah, we know that you get really excited when you don't understand what we're talking about.
It's absolutely right. It's like, oh, I don't know what this is.
But that's I think that's a good point. It's like, it feels like a lot of every engine has their own tools used to do debugging, just because like obviously engines have different strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
So you have to approach it in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
Depending on the tool you're using.
Can I dig into that a little bit?
Yes.
You can.
Okay. So that totally makes sense, right? So like the specific words that you're using, like debug.log, that one you guys said enough that it's going to sink in. So I will remember that it's not print in Unity, it's debug.log.
Yes.
I'll probably ever use it.
Except sometimes when it is, but
mostly
it's not.
No. Okay. But I guess the specifics of for like executing different debug actions and formats and things are going to be different from, you know, engine to engine, tool to tool, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But the processes and purposes behind those specific commands are going to be consistent. So like what's the use case for your debug.log? When do you use it? What problem are you trying to solve when you type in those characters and press enter or whatever? Question.
Very frequently, it's when you run your program and it does something you don't expect it to.
Yes.
And it's the only way to find out is to actually, at the moment where you expect, and this is where you put that statement in the code,
yeah,
is kind of important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because it, a lot of times, and that's why sometimes my debug.logs are just a string that's just 3 exclamation points. Mm-hmm. There's no information in there. The only information I have is when it happens.
Right.
And so if I'm you know, doing like a UI layout, or I have a character jumping or something, and something weird happens, I want to know if a particular block of code is running or not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I put the statement in there, and then if I see it print, then I know the code is running, and right, I know the code isn't working.
Right.
If I don't see the statement, then I know that the code isn't working or isn't running. It may or may not work.
Yeah.
So I need to find, why isn't it running now? I thought I set the condition for it to run such and such.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I work up earlier in the code stack, or the code step through, where how it reaches that code. I find the code I think is going to run before that block. Mm-hmm. Then I put the statement there, and I try it again.
Yep.
And so essentially this is where you'd put the breakpoints in your code editor, is in those same places. Is where you're trying to investigate, where do I want to either see if something happened or didn't happen, or where do I want to get more information about what the current state of something is at this moment?
Right.
Because the thing about code, but especially game code, is that a lot of things change a lot while it's running.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to query things that you've set up processes for.
Yeah.
Especially if you need to be at the controls and you don't have like something to automatically play the game for you, it's actually hard to pay attention to a lot of things at once.
Yeah.
So it kind of just basically is a lens into a moment in as it steps through your code. Because, I mean, we can multi-thread, but essentially like 30 things are happening, but the code is still running in a certain linear order for the most part.
Yes.
And so it's important to say like, oh, this happened in the wrong order. I thought this was supposed to happen first. Then you need to find out how the code is executed. And like, oh, I made a misjudgment here. Oh, or oh, I made a mistake here.
Yeah.
Or oh, I didn't set up the condition here. And the way you do that is to put those breakpoints or those statements in to get that information that you need. And so it's this weird little detective work you have to do into the thing you built.
It's like the analogy that was developing my head as you were describing the process is really kind of like, I don't know, I really like the show House. With all the diagnostics, right? And so like you have a theory, you're like, okay, this didn't work the way that I wanted it to. I'm gonna check out this part of the code, or like you're gonna run this test on the patient, and then you get information back from that test, and you get information back from your debug.log. I had to read it. I'm sorry. I thought I had it, but I had to read it off the notes. And you're like, oh yeah, that totally confirms my hypothesis. Or like, nope, that's not it. We've got to go dig into their kitchen and like look underneath their sink. Or, you know, whatever the analogy is for debugging in code.
It's not a bad analogy in terms of diagnostics, because a lot of times when you investigate different breakpoints or put in different log statements, you are not changing your code. You're not fixing anything yet.
Right.
You're just trying to figure out what's wrong.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, you know what? I think I need to change that, but I'm going to do 3 more tests before I change it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you may not have all the information you think you have. And so it's very important in that kind of experimental diagnostic sort of way to not change the reality on the ground until you find out the real answer.
Yeah,
and that means a lot of times, especially in Unity, like recompiling your code just to process where those statements are.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it kind of tedious and annoying. And that's why breakpoints can be more useful.
Mm-hmm.
But like Steven says, in Unity, sometimes they have some overhead that you don't need or want.
Yeah.
That includes things like memory profiling and stuff like that. And that's one of the other fun things about, like, debugging is great, and I think most people use it in Unity particularly because it's such an engine that does so much for you.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times you just do it's figured if your code is working.
Yeah.
But part of Unity is kind of hidden away. So sometimes you need to know like when the layouts are updating or when or like what order these mono behaviors are executing their awake statements, which you have literally no insight into.
Hmm.
You have to you can either manually determine a script execution order, but if you don't, it kind of happens randomly.
And
your code needs to accept that may happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't be random every time, but if you make changes at that part, so you kind of need to know what what you are certain of and what is uncertain about your code as it's running.
Yep.
And sometimes that involves knowing a little bit more about the engine underneath.
Yeah.
And that's when a lot of developers get very frustrated because they're like, I wouldn't have designed it this way, but I'm not going to change it.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, oh, I'm going to fight against this a little bit, but then I'm going to have more troubles later.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so it ends up becoming not just a process of learning how the problem you have needs to be solved, but you learn a little bit more about your tools as you do this.
Yep.
Especially as you interface more with the engine's tools and the engine's components and the code that is provided by the engine that you are not writing, but you're just linking into through APIs or by interacting with the code that you've written. It can be kind of exciting to like learn a little bit more about how it works, but it could also be frustrating because you felt like, oh, why did I need to know that? I could have just been ignorant and it could have just worked.
Yeah.
Which is really why you use an engine, is so you can be ignorant and it can just work.
Yeah.
So like it can sometimes feel like a sort of false sense of accomplishment to really understand a lot about it. But you're like, well, I haven't made any progress as a result.
Yeah.
You know?
I've done tons of work. I've been here for 6 hours.
Yeah, and I just now know which, you know, weird edge case to avoid.
Yeah.
Yay me, I guess.
Yes.
That could be very exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
So debug.log.
Yes.
I'm just nodding. That's my contribution. That's my end of the contributions to this part of the conversation. Please carry on.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we probably complained enough and described enough the process.
Yeah.
I will say
at least
that
in Unity,
coming from other SDKs which didn't have editors, which was just code, and then you ran the program, and I was much more comfortable using breakpoints and proper debugging tools.
Oh, sure.
In those editors.
That makes sense.
I think a lot of people say this about Unity, that it is very difficult to find a good debugging workflow without just throwing your hands in the air and just using those log statements.
Yeah.
But like I said, you shouldn't feel like you're totally giving up because the editor does give you a lot of insight into your components, into the serialized variables.
Yeah.
So don't feel like a failure if you've just given up on breakpoints.
Yeah. That's actually one thing that I should bring up is that like, if you have private variables, I think those are still, at least they're serialized during the gameplay, so you can switch your, in Unity specifically, so you can switch your node mode from like normal mode to debugging mode, and then it'll show display all those private variables that you have.
Yes, that's a good point.
As long as they're not like static variables.
Yes, and so they're not serialized, but they live in memory while the game is running.
Yes.
And so you can see what they are.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's right. So if you're just using Unity Inspector, then all your public and serialized variables are there.
Mm-hmm.
But like Steven's saying, it's like in the upper right corner of the inspector window.
Yeah, it's not super apparent. I think it's like the little three dash hamburger.
Yeah, maybe we'll find a forum post on this and put it in the show notes because it's a really, really handy tool. If you just go to the debug view, all of the custom drawers that make up an inspector panel or your components, all of that is just removed and you just see all of the data. And it's not that useful to when you're working, but it's extremely useful to see into some of those things.
Yeah.
One of the things I don't like is when I've seen projects do this where you just make all your variables public so that you can see them.
Yeah.
And especially ones you don't intend to change. That makes me very nervous. But
same.
I think that part of that is because maybe I come from a place where private and public variables, that's like an important part of code design.
I mean, I don't, and it bothers me. So.
And so that debug view it's called that because it's debugging, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is again fairly useful as well. And you know, you've got the pause button, which is essentially a breakpoint whenever you want it.
Mm-hmm.
So again, if you feel like you haven't set up debugging properly in Unity, you still have a lot of tools at your disposal. I recommend everybody at least give it a try to set it up and then see if you like working that way. But sometimes you just go back to the even if it's irritating and non-optimal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And like to Mark's point, there are a lot of benefits to doing it using the debugging tool.
Yeah.
So like it is worth pursuing at least just so you know it works. So then you do have a bug and you need to use the debugging tool, you're prepared.
Yeah. One thing I will, the profiler in Unity.
Yes.
Is awful. It's so bad.
Yeah.
And I've used better profiling tools. Like when I used to make Flash apps, there was a great programming tool called Adobe Scout, which is a separate program that is very much like the profiler in Unity. And they've been updated it in like 7 years, but like it is still way better insight into code. And I think that, but you will get irritated by the profiler because it's bad, but it's what you can get from it is really good. So I encourage you to check for that, the profiler panel. Yes,
Alan.
Ellen has her hand raised.
I just wanted to raise my hand and say, I totally agree. The profiler in Unity is garbage. What's a profiler?
Okay, so that was getting to that. So, okay. So a profiler, it lets you know what code is running in a particular frame, and it can let you know what is taking up memory, and it can let you know, it has sort of breaks down what's going on.
Yeah.
In a way that like a debug statement can't necessarily, and even a breakpoint doesn't give you full access to. It, and what's really useful for it is you can see it for memory leaks. So a memory leak is when you create a new object, a new whatever it is, a new object in code,
and it's got a hole in it.
Not quite. But the whole point of memory management in software is when you create a new object, you use it, and then you have to dispose it when you don't need it anymore. And a lot of game engines they abstract that away from the user, meaning the developer. A lot of languages have what's called garbage collection, which is if something is null and hasn't been used in a while, then the memory that has been allocated to it gets freed up after a while.
Yeah.
Okay, so you want to manually destroy those things when you can so that the garbage collector doesn't have to work too hard.
Right.
And sometimes the garbage collector will see a piece of memory of allocated memory and not feel confident enough that it's no longer needed. Mm. There's a reference to it somewhere in your code that hasn't been removed. Mm. So it will just leave it there. And especially if you're creating lots of objects, and if you keep doing that, then that's called a memory leak, where it just gets more and more memory, just starts to fill up with nothing.
Yeah.
And so that, and eventually it will take up all the RAM of a system, or all the one that can be allocated to that process, you know, by whatever machine it's running.
Yep.
The profiler will let you know when that's happening, because you just see the bar graph go up and up and up.
Yeah, it'll just start spiking. Yep.
Right. And what you want to see is you want to see it going up as things are being created, and go down when you're resetting scenes, or you want to kind of understand that. And then you can click and you can pause the editor. And if the memory profile is recording, which is very very intensive on your dev machine, it slows down the game a lot. So it's not very useful for performance metrics. But you can then look at any individual frame that's been recorded, and then you can see where all that memory is going, which code loops are running at that time. So you can see like, oh, I'm running this code in update every frame, but I don't only need to update it like every 20 seconds or something, or every second, or every 5 frames.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you could save 80% of your work if you only need to run it every 5 frames.
Yeah. Right?
And so, I'm running this every frame, but it's so low impact and it's so convenient for me to run every frame that it's okay to be a little wasteful.
Right.
Yep.
So you can make lots of decisions about how your code works. And this is especially true in an engine like Unity, where if you're new to it, it encourages you to put a lot of code in an update loop that runs every frame.
Yeah.
So a lot of times you're running the same code over and over that's just answering the same question again and again. And that can be convenient to do,
yes,
because otherwise you have to set up systems for which when to listen for and when to change
more,
it.
Yeah, more.
There's a lot more work to avoid that. Mm-hmm. If you're using event systems or signals or whatever, it can be a heavy process. But then as your application gets bigger and bigger, you start to start to face the consequences of all that wasted work.
Yes.
And it's hard to know what's useful or not sometimes until you can see what in the profiler, because it will tell you this piece of code took this long to execute.
Yeah.
And you can see how much I have a budget for every frame, which is like 16 point something milliseconds if you're running at 60 frames a second, something like that.
Yeah.
And you can see how much of that budget was taken up by this block of code.
Yes.
And so you can really drill in and decide what's useful and what's not. And you're like, well, I absolutely need this. I absolutely need this. I absolutely need this. And those three things take up 175% of my frame budget.
Oh. So that doesn't work.
So I need to find it to not just removing those things from that particular execution loop, but paring them down.
Yeah.
Or maybe, honestly, sometimes changing your design.
Yeah.
It's like, well, this is the technology is not capable of supporting. And now, of course, the memory profile is running on your dev machine. So you're going to have different performance on different machines.
Yeah.
So it's sometimes very difficult to know, but you can look at frame time and you can see, you can kind of map that a little bit to other, you want a little bit of a buffer if your machine is very powerful. Mm-hmm. If you have a low-end machine, you might be okay running your game at 25 frames a second if you have like a real potato of a PC.
Yeah.
If you're targeting higher specs. So there's still lots of guesswork you have to do, but it gives you a lot more insight than you'd have just from doing debug statements or even breakpoints.
Yeah, I am enjoying revisiting this topic in the way that we are now because, like, I understand the words you're saying.
Yay!
Mostly, anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I have two reactions. It's like, first of all, it sounds like the at least the way that you're describing the profiler seems like it'd be really fascinating to watch. We just like run this and then look at what happens, yeah. and run this and look at what happens. Like, oh, I didn't expect that.
See, then you run into the point that Unity's profiler is kind of garbage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Because it just it takes forever for Unity to do it.
Yeah, it's of these types of, yeah. And if you've never used any other, it can turn you off from using these kinds of tools.
Yeah.
But I would say fight through it if you're a Unity user because it's very, very valuable.
It's very valuable. It's just slow, but yeah. it's worth it.
Just react to it this. Oh no, that's not good. I was gonna say react to it the same way with the same kind of Zen approach that you look at the spinny circle on Netflix. But the thing is, I don't react to that spinny circle on Netflix with a Zen approach.
No.
I'm angry at it. I switched to a different platform. Okay. So the other thing. So do what they said, not what I said. The other thing is, I remember us talking about this with widget satchel development when I designed a level that had mountains of junk.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. There's one section of Widget Satchel, which Ellen designed. So we have junk in the game, which is just physics objects that Sprocket runs into and knocks all over the place. Mm-hmm. It's mostly a aesthetic thing. You can get mischief points by knocking things around.
Yeah.
But there's no puzzles tied to it, right? It doesn't block your path, except for one that Ellen designed. Where you have it's like essentially like a junkyard zone.
Yeah.
Just mountains and mountains of these tiny pieces of junk piled, and you have to create tons of piles of them in order to move a power up through. You know, it uses it in a mechanical way, in a way that I'm a little upset we didn't do more of in the game because it's very clever and it's a lot of fun to play.
And it's really satisfying. It took a lot of work for. Well, you did most of the work on that, Mark, and we only used it for one thing.
Yes, we only used it for one thing. And that's probably partly why I'm upset we didn't use it more.
Yeah,
often.
That's fair.
But it slowed the game down to like 8 frames a second.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't run on Switch at all.
Yeah.
And the memory profiler was the biggest tool I used to be able to know. Okay, I'm going to make this change. By making sure that the physics objects are maybe using less precise calculations, if this is happening, and can I get away with that? If physics objects exist so far outside of Sprocket's field of view or the player's field of view, can we turn them off?
Yeah.
But the puzzle relies on you setting up this machine of junk piling and leaving it alone, like walking away. So this zone was also special in that it needed to actually turn all that stuff on in times that other areas where we had junk we could just turn off once they were off screen.
Yeah.
So there's lots of like bespoke structure for this thing. All of it was worth it, but man, it was difficult. Mm-hmm. And when it finally ran well on Switch, it was like the biggest accomplishment of development in that entire game. And really just highlighted how like valuable it is to really dig in. Because Widget Satchel is not a heavy game.
No.
Yeah. We just like had a particular, and it wasn't super well optimized for the extra load we were putting upon it. And so we had to build these custom things to be able to accommodate. We couldn't rebuild that stuff just for that section. We had to have these basically edge case scenarios.
Right.
And the memory profiler was a huge part of making that work. And all the different things I tried, being able to know what impact they had on frame calculation, can we run the physics through the GPU? It's like, nope, that's way too complicated. And so, you know, in a future, you know, in Super Widget Satchel, maybe. But... you know, what can we save here? Can we cap the physics? Can we drop the physics frame rate? Because our animation frame rate is still at 60. So maybe Sprocket's jumps will be less precise, but does this game really need that? Mm. And so it's overkill in most other sections of the game. So can we save a little time and increase our physics frame budget? And so lots of that, in order to know if any of that worked and which optimizations were not worth bothering with or didn't help a lot.
Right.
Or would cause too many consequences to be worth it. The memory profiler was a huge part of that process.
It gave you the information you needed to make decisions without having to spend so much time just like trial and error.
Yeah. And I still spent a lot of time trial and error.
Yeah.
And so without it, it wouldn't have happened. Like, there's just no way. Sometimes you do need, even when you're making games that aren't taxing your system, like, and you have a lot of overhead to waste, which a lot of us indie developers do. And there's a real advantage to that.
Yeah.
It's very good to not worry about perfect optimization.
Yeah.
It's not the best use of your time.
Most of the time we're not making games on the NES. So
exactly.
We can afford that.
But occasionally you have occasion to. And so that was very, very useful then.
Yeah.
Occasionally there's just literally enough junk in your game that you need to do it.
Yep. Yes. And I would say like, well, there's a section of that level that Ellen put like 75 exploding barrels, each with their own particle systems. And when they blow up, then it blows up the one next to it. So all of that. And so we have We have 72 independent particle systems exploding, and all those physics forces like blowing the different chunks of each piece on there. And so like I removed as many as I could without angering Ellen and still being true to the design of it.
Yeah. Mark, you weren't supposed to tell Ellen that.
I know.
This is the first I've ever heard of this. Flip the table here. Yeah. What do you mean they're not real explosions?
But that's, you know, those are the balances you do. Like, yeah. Well, do I want it to have this many exploding barrels, but kind of be choppy? And that's fine, maybe, because it's just that moment. Yeah. Or do we want it to look really smooth, but only have like 52 barrels? And can we arrange it in a way that still is true to the like the layout that you plan for the level and in terms of how the player feels when they get there? So a lot of this comes down to like game design sensibilities.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I want to talk about. A good segue to the sort of final piece of this,
yeah,
which is about the sort of which we talked about at the very beginning, which is the sort of philosophy of like fixing bugs.
Yeah.
Like, do you just prototype fast, move fast, break things, fix it later? Or do you just stop in your tracks? There's a spectrum here.
Right.
But, you know, or do you just stop in your tracks and fix things as soon as they're a problem? And one of the things that that works for me as a developer stopping in my tracks is because I'm kind of generally also working on design questions. And also testing to see if this feels good. Hmm. Like a lot of times, if I leave those things alone, they can have consequences in those realms.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
In a way that is probably not as true for perhaps more highly structured and organized teams.
Yeah, actually, that's a good way. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think about like when I'm implementing new functions and stuff in game, whatever game I'm working on, and I discover that there's this thing is not working the way I had intended it to, or how we had intended it to, I will oftentimes stop implementing this feature to fix this bug, because, well, one, I discovered it, so like, and I'm here, and it's probably only take me 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But also, I say that now, but it might take me 30. and also, like, it will probably impact like the work I'm doing now. So it makes sense to fix this before I fix other things, or before I continue with other work. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Now there are, I mean, there's certainly, we've sort of talked a little bit about the downsides, but like it's really easy to lose momentum.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is when you're working on something and then you get waylaid by something else, then you get really focused on that. And maybe because I have this addictive personality, it's easy for me to get trapped into this other thing. And then I have to get back to the thing I took off.
Yeah.
You kind of have to, you know, dog ear the page in your, you know, and like be able to pick up exactly what I was like, what was I doing?
Right.
And what did I learn on this process that's going to change what I was doing? Or can I just go right back to what I was doing?
Yeah.
That requires a lot of discipline to be able to do, because sometimes you'll get caught up in fixing this thing and then you'll fix it and you'll be like, well, what? Where do I go now?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I go back to the thing I was doing. And then instead I just start fixing other little bugs that are completely separate from that process that don't need my attention right now. Mm-hmm. And that can be very difficult.
Yes.
And so it slows you down, but it can slow you down in unpredictable ways.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably its biggest drawback, is that it's very hard to, beyond facing that now, because I'm accountable to a team and to a publisher.
Right.
And at no point have I felt the stress from them. So like, to be very clear, like this is all just self-imposed. Like, you know, we're all keeping each other very updated on what's happening. So there's no surprises to anybody. Mm-hmm. But when you are accountable to others, it is very frustrating to go back to them the next day and say, sorry, my estimate for Thursday, it's actually next Tuesday. And then go back, you know, over that weekend and say, it's actually this upcoming Friday because these other things popped up.
Yeah.
And, you know, even when you don't feel like that anyone's going to give you any crap for it, you, like it feels, it doesn't feel good to not be able to estimate how long it will take.
Yeah.
And that is happens more so when you encounter these unexpected things that break.
Yes.
And then sometimes you fix them and then you're like, well, as long as I'm here fixing them, I will improve it a little bit too. Mm-hmm. So using your time, like, well, so it's really very difficult when you're working on your own project or with a smaller team where you set your own deadlines together. And there's less of that accountability. It's much easier, but on the flip side, you can find yourself not have any stress on you to move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
Right. And you can just keep spinning your wheels on a thing until it's not just fixed, but perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's not good either.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say there's lots of downsides to this process.
Right.
I'm trying to explore them all because I don't think I'm going to change. And so I just want to be a, I just want to be aware of how this works.
Yeah, yeah. But well, on the flip side, if I may,
yes.
The
you may
the way I tend to go about things. I also have the issues you're describing, right? Where like you'll get into bug fixing, and then that's the that a whole day runs by, and you're like, what was I supposed to actually be doing? but on the other hand, a lot of times, what I will try to do is I will try to implement things very quickly, and so that like you know people can get work done that they need to get done.
Yes.
And then it will cause problems down the line, so I have to fix those things later.
Yes. So that is especially when you have dependencies with, yes. With other people's work.
Right, right, right. I don't want to slow other people down. Like, especially in my new job, I'm the only programmer and I don't want to slow anybody down. So I have been working very quickly because like the game we were working on, like I think was in the back burner for a while. So I made a prototype first day on the job. They really like that.
Woo-hoo.
I think I've said that a few times. Yeah. I'm proud of that.
We're proud of you too, Steven.
So I did that really fast because like I wanted them to experience the game that they've been trying to, you know, envision for a while. And so like I put in all of these features and stuff very fast so that like people could, you know, start seeing the game. But as a result of that, like there are a lot of the systems that I put in there were kind of systems I made for myself because I knew I could work with them really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But like sometimes like we the things I worked on were impediments to others because like I worked on them and I knew how they worked, but like I didn't really describe how they worked in the code.
Right.
Or
you end up saddling your dependencies or your dependence
yes.
with the flaws that you put in to make it go quickly.
Yes.
So you can build things on shaky foundations.
Yes.
Now, if everybody understands that.
And they did.
It can still be, like, I don't want to like tear down that approach because that can still ultimately be better in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you can move quicker. You can incorporate more of your design thinking into that process.
Yeah.
The changes you make, because it's kind of, it's a sandcastle anyway. So it's okay to break it apart and make it something different.
Yeah.
It does take your refactor costs happen later in the process.
Yes.
And it requires you to do a lot more tracking.
Yes.
Of like, this is a bug. It's not a showstopper. We can leave it alone, but you have to log it.
Yeah.
Everything you've learned, like you need to put it down somewhere. And what happens to me is if I'm doing that, I might as well fix it.
Yeah.
But the idea is if you don't have time or you'd really rather be doing something else, it'd be more effective to do something else. So that you can work together with your team,
right?
You let that one go, but so none of these are efficient. That's the key. It's like you're always going to find like, well, this is not efficient for this reason, but you got to let that go sometimes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and I think it depends on like where you're at. Like with we're making a prototype, and my plan was to eventually throw away a lot of the code that I did, take what I learned from doing this prototype in this mm-hmm. way, and use that to finish the final game down the line with new information and like be slower about it. So I probably get closer to what you're doing. but like in the same vein, I think that it's important to I found that like the way that I go about with my normal day to day, this current thing is like I'll implement a bunch of new features 1 week and then the next week fix a bunch of bugs that when I implemented new code and stuff.
Because
I tend to do it quick and then just come back and fix that stuff so that it's better. And overall, eventually, like the code just improves over time. At least that's the goal. That's
really interesting for like from a psychological perspective, right? Because one of the things we haven't said these words in this episode, but we've been dancing around the issue often is the cost of task switching. There's a mental cost to task switching, right? So you're doing one thing. And then there's a bug and you have to go fix it. Or do you want to keep going on this? You know, there's like a huge mental effort in trying to switch your brain from being focused on one task to another.
Right.
And what the process you described is really interesting because you release new code 1 week and then you spend like the next week on debugging. That context is still like fresh in your mind.
Yeah.
So you're gaining some efficiencies there. It's still not overall like maybe. You're always going to have inefficiencies, right?
Yeah.
Like you have a meat computer and that's what's running your whole thing,
mm-hmm.
right? Like it's no, you know, yeah. Anyway, there are always going to be inefficiencies when people are involved.
Yeah.
Well, this also, it comes down to like planning out the order in which you're going to build your game.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because you can plan for, oh, we're going to work fast.
Mm-hmm.
So let's plan for a lot of things that are not dependent on each other. So we can work fast, test them, and then we can stitch them together. With some glue code that we can throw away later
mm-hmm.
before we have to worry about fixing everything.
Yeah.
Or this is really going to, we need to get this finished before we can work on this next thing. And this next thing is important. So for now, we're all just going to focus on this until it's essentially done.
Yeah.
Knowing that once the rest of it's built, we'll have to come back and make some changes, of course.
Right.
But like, that's the different kind of refactor cost. It's like, you can't perfect it now because the rest of the gap isn't done.
Yep.
So you're going to come back there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I'm always open to refactoring. So like, that doesn't bother me, but like that can be, that can be, especially if you spend a lot of time making it actually work. And then realizing that, oh, I actually need to rebuild part of this that I spent all this time bug fixing. In my mind, sometimes that can be fine because you fixed all the bugs that would happen. So when they're not going to happen again.
Mm.
Other times it could be, well, I need to take a different approach. And all that bug fixing I did was pointless.
Yeah.
Which has definitely happened to me.
Yeah.
But it, how you plan it is important because then it should be conducive to what you how you expect to work or how you plan to work
mm-hmm.
when it comes to actually fixing problems
yes.
that show up or letting them sit and tracking them and maybe even having, especially if you have a QA department who can actually like work with builds, if you do weekly builds, if you're that kind of team that people can actually check out, then like that kind of workflow, that like tracking process can be really important. I think for a lot of us on smaller teams, that doesn't really happen.
Mm.
And so we can't assume a workflow which expects it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So Ellen,
mm-hmm.
you feel like you have enough to go out into the world and debug whatever software you write in the future?
Super not.
Okay.
okay.
But I know debug.log.
There we go.
And we talked about process a lot too, right? So one of the things Stephen has been resistant to the idea of talking about hiatus projects, but I am excited to spend more time with Godot.
Yeah.
During hiatus, and maybe I will have to do some debugging, or maybe not. Or maybe I'll think about it and I won't. And here's a goal for you. I'm going to come back from hiatus and I'm going to be able to tell you the Godot version of debug.log.
Ooh, let's go.
Yeah.
I like that because I don't have to do any work.
Yeah. Well, that your summary of like, I sort of know what you're talking about, but I'm not prepared to do it. And maybe I'll be better in the future. That's just the whole thing. That's what it is for all of us.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So
pretty much.
Excellent summation.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
All right, I'm going to give you three hints, maybe four hints, and you're going to tell me what the object is.
Okay.
Okay.
We can do that.
This is not actually going to work because you already know what I'm going to talk about.
No, I don't.
Don't
I
break
definitely
the illusion.
Don't. No.
Okay, cut that then. So, here are your hints. It's uh-huh. got our logo on it.
A mouse pad.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea. It makes a great gift.
A mouse pad.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what makes a good gift.
A mouse pad's like a stocking stuffer. It's not like a gift. Like, hey, here's my...
yeah, okay, that's
happy
fair.
Birthday. Here's
yeah,
your
that's,
mouse pad.
That's a pretty that's bad a, gift.
All the stores were closed. This is what was in my closet.
okay, so we're no closer than we were after the first hint.
Right. Okay, cool.
It can show your friends that you're part of the Nice Games Clubhouse.
Oh, wait a minute. That's an idea is starting to form.
It's yeah. got a logo on it. It makes a great gift.
A receipt from Patreon.com? No, we're not doing that one.
No, it's not Patreon.com.
Okay.
No.
Show your friends you're part of the clubhouse. Yeah. I'm actually thinking like a really cool like blinged out necklace with the logo would be all those things.
Ooh,
but
yeah.
the fourth
now
clue...
Now getting distracted.
The fourth clue is going to nix that idea. Yeah. It's The fourth clue is it's soft.
Oh, I got it. It's a hamster.
It's got our logo on it?
You don't know all the hamsters.
Maybe it's a hamster with a t-shirt.
Oh, that's fun.
It's the t-shirt. You
it's
guys.
The t-shirt.
We
it's
have a t-shirt.
You know, looking back, those were pretty good hints.
Yeah, that's very clever.
Stephen wrote them. we have a t-shirt. It's all the things that I said, and I will reemphasize that it's soft. We've had people ask about how the heck it's so soft, and I'm going to say debug.log did it. And also, you can get it at nicegames.club/shirt. I'll say it again, slower this time. Mm-hmm. Nicegames.club/shirt.
Slow boat.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, so Stephen, moving on to the second topic we want to talk about today, we were going to talk about, I think, the silent protagonist. So what do you want to say? And that's our show.
No, we have an actual topic right here.
We couldn't resist. I'm not sorry. So, silent protagonist. What is a silent protagonist?
You can talk now.
Yeah, okay.
The bit is over.
Yeah. Silent protagonist is basically you play as a character who doesn't really say much. They'll, you know, do some shouts and grunts and junk, but like nothing. They don't really speak full sentences. Mm-hmm. They're really there for the player to, like, you know, embody as the person experience in the world.
Yeah.
In the world that you're playing in.
And specifically the expression of that is that they are generally silent.
Yes.
But that's not really what it is. It's that they are essentially like tabula rasa.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. They're bare bones. They don't really have a personality so that the player can put the personality onto them effectively. Right. And so I guess they wanted to talk about, like, what are situations when you want a silent protagonist? What are situations when it doesn't make any sense to have a silent protagonist? Why games do this? Mm. I guess we just talked about it. The reason why is because players want, like, they want to be able to embody the world in certain aspects. And so, like, it allows them to do that in a way that works for the game. So, like, an example of a silent protagonist would be, like, Link in Legend of Zelda game. Mm-hmm. Does not speak. There are other characters that oftentimes follow Link and will be annoying and talk for him.
Yeah.
Hey, listen.
You know, exactly. I might have said this on the show before, but in Breath of the Wild, Link is not a silent protagonist. The character just doesn't speak.
Yeah.
Like, you get into conversations with other players and you see Link kind of gesture with their hands.
Yeah.
And then the other player or the other NPC goes, so you're telling me that blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And that's how you learn what Link said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like completely nonsensical.
It's really weird.
And as games get more robust, the characters tend to have Link in Breath of the Wild. Actually, Link in a lot of the more recent games, the past 15 years, has more of a personality.
Yeah.
But still is on the top of the list of silent protagonists.
Yeah.
I don't know how true that is. It's a dimension, right?
I mean, I would argue that Link is still a silent protagonist in Breath of the Wild, less so perhaps, only in that, like, some of his personality
traits. Link tells people things.
Yeah, exactly. And then he literally does talk.
Yeah.
But I think that, like, generally speaking, whatever he says is not important. Because, like, really what happens is, like, the characters talk at him. Like, the example you just proposed is, like, Link does a bunch of gestures and stuff, and then, like, the person he's talking to is like, so what you're saying is this, 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 but the person who he's talking to is actually doing the expressing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd still push back on that, but okay. In all the cut scenes, especially the flashbacks,
yes,
where Link is present, Link has essentially nothing to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not even in that fake way. Mm-hmm. So he's very much silent in those.
Yeah, he's just there.
Sure. Yeah.
It's a little weird, actually.
You said, anything they express or do is irrelevant. It does not have any impact on other characters.
Exactly. Well, that's a good point, because, like, Mario is another example of a silent protagonist, but he's, you know, very expressive in his animations, his movements, his let's-a-goes or whatever.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, like, he's still expressive, but, like, he's still a silent protagonist in that he doesn't really have personality in a way that, like, basically his personality is upbeat, and that's kind of it. So, like, because the rest of the world is that, so it doesn't really come across as him playing through a story, I guess. It's kind of weird. It comes across as you playing an avatar in this world.
So
you're playing.
Right. And whatever personality Mario has, you are meant to adopt.
Yes.
And so it's still supposed to be you.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's exactly where my head was going with it. It's like, well, okay, so it doesn't, there's a personality, but you're invited to adopt that personality.
Yeah.
Rather than like you're not, you know, you're not playing a character like you would be in a play where you have to adopt the whole like mindset and all mm-hmm. the beliefs and the history and everything like that. It's it's just like an outfit. It's like a personality outfit.
Yeah.
Now compare that to like Luigi in Luigi's Mansion.
Right.
Or Captain Toad in Captain Toad Treasure Tracker.
Yeah.
The best Mario game ever made.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm putting it. I just love that
game. It's good though. Yeah.
Yeah. Those characters are similar in that they provide just as much to you as Mario does in any of those games, but they have more distinct, specific personalities.
Right.
I mean, I guess you could still call them silent protagonists, but I don't know that I'd go that far.
No. I definitely agree with you. I would say, argue that like Luigi and Luigi's Mansion is like scared a lot of the time, where most players, I'm not one of them, would not be scared. I'm a wimp when it comes to horror things.
But you're meant to observe Luigi being scared.
Yes, because like that is the environment, and Luigi is in that environment, and you as the player are watching and playing as Luigi in that environment, but Luigi's the one supposed to be scared.
Yeah.
The player is not supposed to be scared. Most of the time. so like it, I think it works like in that respect too. And admittedly, I haven't played a ton of Captain Toad's Treasure Tracker, but I like his, you know, upbeat can do attitude, ready for adventure thing.
Yeah.
Is, well, I think he's a little closer to Mario, but maybe less so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, Captain Toad and Captain Toadette have like there's a motivation there that is different from like Mario and Peach.
Yeah.
In that like Toadette appears in more of the cutscenes and there's more of that drive, whereas you, the player, are just trying to get trying to beat the level.
Mm-hmm.
And so it feels more of a disconnect.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But it's less necessarily about if you feel ready for adventure.
Yeah.
Like Captain Toad does.
Yeah.
And more that Captain Toad is just very specific.
Sure.
Like, you know, like his backpack is too heavy.
Yeah.
And like, but he wants to get those coins anyway. And he's not going to take off that backpack just because he's on an adventure to save somebody. Like, you know, it's so specific. Whereas Mario just feels more like easier to embody.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, that's, I mean, like, maybe it's a sin to bring up the Mario movie, but.
Gasp.
You mean the new one, because it's perfectly okay to bring up the old one.
Oh, well, yeah. But well, actually, that's the thing. It's like the old one and the new one, they're going to have to bring a personality to Mario where there isn't really one in the game.
Yeah, yeah.
The old one, you know, made Mario like kind of grumpy and old and get off my lawn a little.
Yeah.
And even in the show, like Mario had a personality that was actually kind of like that. In the new movie, I don't know how they're going to do it, but Chris Redd's playing it. So
I learned a couple years ago that Mario is supposed to be like 32. Just like, how does that make sense?
I know.
Because I think a lot about like the Bob Hoskins playing Mario. Like, not that that's foundational to my understanding of Mario, but I think of Mario as like someone who's just older than me no matter how old I get.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. I'm older than Mario? Oh, no. Nope. I reject that reality.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
So, like, another instance of a game, well, we're just going to talk about Nintendo games now, I think. Another instance of a game that is not a silent protagonist is Metroid. Because Samus, you know, I mean, oftentimes Samus is silent, largely because she's, like, by herself. Part of the themes of those games are isolation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, it doesn't really make, well, I guess games do this thing a lot where they're, like, you know, walking in their room by themselves. And they're like, oh, that's a nice book that, you know, talk their ideas out.
See, that never bothered me because I do that all the time.
I do too, but like it's weird still. I live by myself. I'm constantly talking to myself.
I guess I'm talking to the dogs. I'll be like, Pixel, what do you think? These shoes or those shoes? And she'll like roll over on her tummy or on her back and just like put her legs in the air. I'll be like, I agree. Yes. Totally.
Yeah, I don't have that excuse. I have no pets.
Okay.
but like Samus goes through, you know, turmoil and things. Well, I guess all of these characters technically do. But, like, she still, like, expresses things. There are certain cutscenes and stuff where Samus has agency where these other characters do not.
I think the exception to that is the very first Metroid.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Where Samus is a total cipher.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she was a woman, it was, like, a thing that most players didn't know.
Right.
Because I think you didn't just have to beat the game. You had to, like, do something special to find that, right?
Yeah.
It was like an Easter egg.
Well, no, I think it was... No, you know, you're right. Because, like, even in the... I think they lied to the players in the instruction books and said that...
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it might have just been a case of like, no one cared enough to...
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps.
And the character wasn't real enough at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But starting with Metroid 2 on the Game Boy,
yeah.
much more focus on story and,
yes.
and relationships between those characters.
Yep.
but I think she started out.
That's fair. I think you're absolutely right. But yeah, no, she like, you know, there are things that happen to her and she like expresses how she feels about those things in a lot of the game.
Yeah, and some games more than others for sure. But yeah, she does have, she says things, she has opinions.
But she doesn't talk that much. Like even Half-Life, I haven't played Half-Life, but I know that like that Gordon Freeman, that's his name, right? Told you I hadn't played it. He, you know, is an actual character. He has a history. He has things that happen to him too in the game. But
he is technically silent in a way that is sometimes poked fun at that series. But yeah, he is a specific character.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So he's not a silent protagonist because it's not some the character or the player cannot pretend that they are in the game because this is a separate person.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I think because the other Valve silent protagonist is Chell from Portal.
Yeah, that's true.
Who has a very, even in the first game, is very much personified and characterized by GLaDOS. But is silent, and the player is meant to take on the role of that character.
Yeah,
sure.
In a way. So this is where the definitions get kind of fuzzy, and I think there's like room for debate. But it kind of brings back to like the... I think the idea of a silent protagonist as a lens by which to view these characters is and it's probably why we're talking about Nintendo so much.
Yeah.
It's like a relic of the way games just used to be made.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
like pretty frequently, even modern games with lead characters, the lead characters usually don't do the most talking.
Yes.
Because they're meant to be the player, even if they're very specific characters. That's pretty true in a lot of franchises.
That's right? True. Yeah. I'm thinking about like a lot of RPGs, modern RPGs have, you know, the character doesn't really speak, doesn't really have a personality. And like other people speak for them. But like, I think a lot of times there's like just like one personality trait that they like are. Like, I'm thinking about like Persona 5. Like the main character, you know, high school student, but like his main personality trait is he's cool. High school students.
So the player can't embody that.
No.
Or is it just me?
I mean, they can, I guess. It makes the player feel cool. But like, I think that like, that's like his only personality trait for the most part. And so other characters around him get to be more expressive. And you as the player can react to those expressions.
Yeah.
But the player or the character himself in Persona 5 does not, you know, actually do that himself.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird.
The one I'm thinking of that uses it in an interesting way is BioShock.
Okay.
Where it's a silent protagonist and there's his, you know, the sort of moral choices, which people have made a lot of fun of, but, you know, was interesting in its era.
Right, right.
And so it really was meant to be you embodying them. But you start out looking at your own hands and you see like a tattoo. And so you know the character has specificity.
Yes.
That you know, can or cannot relate to in certain degrees. But you know it's not you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's not you who crashed into Rapture.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it still feels like you're the one making the choices and that's a big part of it. So it is a silent protagonist in that sense.
Yeah.
And then the big twist at the end is, you know, who you are and why you're there and what value your choices have. And so it kind of plays with that language, which is sort of interesting.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I feel that that's interesting. Whereas, and this is another reason, anytime I talk about BioShock, I always bring it back to why BioShock Infinite is not good.
Yeah.
But in that game, it plays similarly, but the character you are has a backstory and all the way from the beginning and a very rich, and then the twist is interesting.
Yeah.
And it doesn't play with that language as much.
Yeah.
But I guess that's the question I want to ask you about, like, you know, I mean, it's kind of what's next on the bullet point is like, what use is this as a tool?
Like,
yeah, I mean,
as a mechanic or as a immersion technique or as a storytelling thing?
I feel like it's mostly beneficial for like players to be able to feel like they can embody whatever character that you're playing as.
Yeah.
Or that emotion. I think because I think you brought up a good point with like Mario technically has a personality in that he's upbeat. But like it's not his personality is expressed through the player's actions mostly. So the player really kind of expresses those actions that personality trait of Mario in a way that other games, when they have distinct characters, do not do that.
Yeah, think about like a Braid is specifically a take on Mario.
Yeah.
And that character is a bummer the whole way through.
Yeah.
and so the game feels different. Right?
Totally.
But also a silent protagonist.
Right? Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. That's a good example of that. Yeah. So I think that like the benefits of Silent Protagonist is mostly that, like, it gives the player, it helps the player give themselves permission to feel that the emotion that we as developers want them to experience as a player or as a character.
Yeah,
that's a little confusing.
That's what we did with Sprocket.
That is what we did with Sprocket. Right? Yeah, we wanted players to feel, you know, mischievous.
Yeah, a little goofy, a little unsteady on their feet.
Yeah.
And so I would never really describe Sprocket as a silent protagonist because they have personality.
Yeah.
But by these terms, I suppose so.
Yeah. Well, Sprocket also never speaks, but, you know.
Sprocket's a ferret, so it's logical.
Yeah.
They're not an unusually silent protagonist.
Yeah.
Unusual in other ways, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Socks.
Yeah. Yeah, but that I think that, like, when you're talking about specific stories, I think it's important to make sure that your character is not a silent protagonist. Mm-hmm. Like, I think of a lot of like Final Fantasy games are telling specific stories for the main character in a way that probably wouldn't work if the character was silent the whole time.
Right.
Because then, like, well, because it feels counter to the narrative in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're experiencing the story that this character is experiencing, but you are not experiencing the story the same way. It's kind of hard to talk about because it feels like, obviously, you as a player, you're experiencing the story, but like the character you're playing as expresses their own reaction to things that are happening.
Yeah. Ellen, did you hear that? He said it's hard to talk about.
What? Oh, because silent.
It's funny. I got it. I got it. I got there.
I got it.
I got there. It's good.
Yep. Took me a little bit too. That was good. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm thinking about like a bunch of different like Final Fantasy games that do that. I can't think of any other JRPGs. I don't play a lot of JRPGs that do that other than Final Fantasy. I feel like Final Fantasy is unique in that respect in a lot of ways, in that like you play as a specific character who has a specific personality. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it seems to me that personality is brooding or, you know, a teenager.
Yeah, the same person. They so all it's have not, the same personality.
Yeah. But like when things happen in the game, like you as the player do not express how you feel about it. The character expresses how they feel about it, and you just agree with them a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
The same way that you'd agree with a movie protagonist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the movie, of course, there are lots of protagonists, I guess, that suck and you're not supposed to agree with them, but
yeah,
you're following their story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fully their story.
Well, just being a protagonist provides a lot of inbuilt empathy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, it's why people like Rick Sanchez or Walter White, like, even though you're not supposed to.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. 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 And actually, that's a good point. Like, it's the same as like games like Last of Us Part Two and stuff. Like, I mean, Ellie is, you know, a fully fleshed out character.
Yeah.
But you play as her and you experience these things and she's doing stuff that you definitely don't want her to do.
Well, and you play as her, like, mortal rival.
Right. Exactly.
And that's, you know, that credit to that game. Mm-hmm. By doing that, it lets players have different feelings and make different like choices in their mind,
right,
that are independent from the gameplay.
Yes,
about what those characters are, and it lets you examine that in ways that other games don't always do.
Right, right. And it, you know, you wouldn't be able to do that if Ellie was a silent protagonist and didn't have personality.
Right.
So I think it's important. Yeah, I think it is valuable to have a silent protagonist when it's important for the player to be able to express their emotions in the game.
Mm-hmm.
I think it, but when you're trying to create, you're trying to have the player experience a narrative, and it's not important, and in fact is probably beneficial that the player does not experience the same emotions that the character you're playing as has, then you do not want to sign a protagonist. This seems like an overarching rule.
Yeah, I think so. I think I understand where you're headed with it. And I think I was kind of headed in the same direction for a conclusion, which is just really, it depends on what type of experience you want and what kind of story you want to tell, right? So like you're going through Breath of the Wild, the emotions that the player is going to have come through their actions directly involving the game right? Because Link as a silent protagonist isn't like a medium for that. His like the body is, the personality is, I guess, but like the his story is not an intermediary really, because he doesn't really have a story.
Right.
So it's more of like that kind of direct connection. Whereas with, if you have a protagonist that has like a very fleshed out characterization, you're experiencing the game world and the game story kind of through that. Adapter? I don't know. Like it's another layer of meaning on top of it, which just gives a different flavor, different texture to the whole experience.
Yeah.
It just depends on what you want.
It sounds like how important is this character to the world, right? How tied up are they into the plot? Maybe helps determine whether it's useful to have a silent protagonist or whether to like buck convention or subvert the form, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Mario's got to rescue Peach, but like anybody could rescue Peach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Mario may be uniquely motivated, but then any silent protagonist could be.
Sure. Yeah. How interesting or important is the full character in unfolding the game story?
Yeah. Personal it is to them.
How personal is it? Like, is it really important that you know all of, you know, Link's favorite food dish and, you know, yeah, like why he wears the hat? And
well, okay. So that's an interesting question. So like I'm thinking of Shadow of the Colossus.
Yeah.
That is a very personal story. In that, like, you play as this, I don't think the character ever speaks, but, like, you play as this character who's trying to revive this girl. I don't know, fully understand how that game
works. It's a deal with the devil kind of story.
Basically, yes.
Basically, where you do these, and you, as the player, you come to learn the deal that the character has made.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what I like about that narratively is that it is a silent protagonist,
yeah,
but only for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, you realize it wasn't all along.
Yeah.
You know?
That's cool.
At least by the definition we've been setting up.
Yeah.
Is that true. It is meant to be you until you realize that what choices the character has made versus the choices you as a player has made.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. 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 Exactly. Yeah. So that's a good point. So that, yeah, definitely. Transitioning between silent and non-silent protagonist.
Exactly.
I mean, we might be complicating it, but it's because we're having these fuzzy definitions, it allows for this kind of playing with the form, or at least in terms of a critical eye,
yes,
how we interpret. You might have a developer who just described it that way and didn't think any further on it, but that's the difference between creation and criticism, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, yeah. Ultimately, it is a useful tool for creation purposes when you just you don't want your protagonist to say words.
Yeah.
Because then it values.
But I would say, don't worry about having a checklist of if it meets all the criteria or not.
Yeah.
Like, feel free to be flexible.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Frankly, you can have you could literally have a silent protagonist, except they're not silent at the end, and that would be interesting, right?
Yeah.
Like a character that, you know, says one sentence.
It'd be really interesting to have a character who you're meant to embody, but then at the very end, they pull away from the player and comment on and have opinions about the experience.
Oh,
in a way that maybe challenges how the player experienced it.
Oh, you know? That's cool.
Widget Satchel 2.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we do a little bit of that in a sense of like Sprocket's motivations is different from the player's motivations.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, and we reveal that sort of subtly in a way that I don't think a lot of players are meant to, you know, it's a subtext.
Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's more you could do with that.
Yeah. Everyone has the option of reading games that deeply, but not every game is constructed and designed and created with the intent for players to read it that deeply.
Yeah.
Right. So. Yep. Cool. Should I go silent again? Is that how this is going to work?
Nah, I don't think
no, you should just chatterbox all the way through the outro.
That's our show. Check out our website, nicegames.club, for show notes and links to resources on today's topics. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode, on the funny sounds we made, and on our programming in general. Go to nicegames.club/feedback and tell us what you think. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter at nicegamesclub, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and a timely reminder.
That sounds way darker than I intended it to be. It's a nice thing.
Oh, sorry. A timely reminder. Or you can email us through contact@nicegames.club. Want to support the show? Yay, thank you. There are so many ways. You can give us a review on your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends about your favorite episodes, maybe by getting them a t-shirt. Join us on Discord by visiting nicegames.club/discord. And we are on Patreon. As a patron of the show, you'll enjoy bonus content, extra jokes, more funny noises, and additional stuff. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
So until we start again, by which time you have gone to nicegames.club/shirt and picked up one of our lovely soft t-shirts, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Okay, so that was that. and
huh?
What?
Ah! Ah!
That wasn't the transition we talked about, Steven.
Yeah, I'm gonna put a pause on the show right now.
I think I missed that conversation.
No, you were here the whole time,
but I wasn't listening.
I absolutely love what you just did.
I'm sorry.
So Steven. Are we just going to roll it or are we going to try?
No, let's start over.
Yeah, that's fine.
That's definitely going at the end of the show, though.
Yes, it is.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.